You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jemima Houston talking oa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Tuesday, the 27th of April. My name is Jemima and I'm your host and I'm joined in studio by Lyric. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. We've had a good day on The Wire. We're feeling very, prepped and ready to go. It's all very exciting. Some good stuff coming up on the show today. We have a new segment from Isla and Stella, who are looking at the world as we know and how technologies and scientific issues affect people and our futures. This week, they're looking at Elon Musk's Neuralink brain chip. Following a state government crackdown on teachers found politicising the classroom in New South Wales, in Australia, I am questioning the sentiment, politics has no place in the classroom. I speak to the parents group of the school involved in the Australian crackdown to hear the school's story, and I also talk to Victoria University of Wellington lecturer in education, Bronwyn Wood, and NZEI Te Reo Roa president, Liam Rutherford, about where Aotearoa stands on whether politics has a place in the classroom. Who did you talk to today, Lyric?
Today I talked to... I talked yesterday to Awarangi Tamahere from Te Whanau o Waipareira about their Proud to be Māori campaign. And this morning I spoke with Shazaya Salim from Ngāti Whātua Ōrākei about their Body WAF program, which is kicking off today.
Yeah, so we have some really good pieces coming up today. So e aho whakaaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces. So tukupātui mai, you can send us through a text on 5395 or wai mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Also, after the show, koe e wariwari e ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō, he pakihiri rukiruki marunga i te pai tukituku o irirangi poho. Mi haere ki 95 BFM Irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95 BFM website, 95bfm.com. Just head up to the right under BCasts. We're there and you can check out all the awesome pieces that the news team have been doing on The Wire. For a really long time. You can go back as a few years ago. You can see what was going on a while ago. Or you can see what was going on last week, which is nice. But anyway, we'll crack into it because there's lots of stuff to get through.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
If you're tuning in from Auckland today, you may have noticed throughout the past week a number of posters popping up with the sentence, Proud to be Māori, beside the faces of notable Māori figures such as Rawiri Waititi and Sir Peter Sharples. These posters are part of an 8-week campaign by Te Whanau o Waipareira to celebrate Māori identity and offer a message of hope. I spoke with Waipareira COO Awarangi Tamahere to discuss how it feels to see a message of Māori pride on a wide scale, the struggle for urban Māori, and the support provided by her group. But first, I asked about the history of Te Whanau o Waipareira and the inspiration behind their campaign.
Well, Te Whanau o Waipareira was set up in the, in the 1980s, but it was based on urban Māori who had moved to the city from rural areas, and it was about how do they reconnect in the city and build on these strengths to meet the challenges. And so Whanau Waipareira was born out of that vision, if you like. And since that time, it's been there advocating for their communities, advocating support for rangatahi, elders, parents, children, and making sure that the services they need get to them. But you know what it's like over many decades, the issue that we face at Whanau Waipareira is so many of our people are still despondent, have still got massive challenges to face them, whether it be living in homes, whether it be able to access the right care that they need. And that came to the fore in COVID for us, you know, and we just thought, gosh, you still need to send a message of hope. You still need to send a message of belief, and that no matter what is happening out there, that we actually do care for you, And so we thought, well, after COVID, it's another challenge, it's another battle for our communities. Let's just send a message out there about, no, we've got this, we can do this. Yes, the struggle's tough, but we can make changes that matter most in our communities. So that was probably the inspiration that sat behind this campaign.
And I've seen your message all over social media on TikTok and Facebook and Instagram, and I've passed a few of your posters on the way to the newsroom this morning as well. How does it feel seeing the sentence, proud to be Māori, displayed on such a huge scale?
We never in our wildest dreams thought it would go on this scale, because this was actually targeted at Auckland and in particular West Auckland. So I think for us, we didn't realise that message would just resonate right across the country in so many ways, you know, about some that are in a struggle, some are in the process of moving on and being forward and having cool role models to see. We just never expected this. But you know, the cool thing is we run this program called Waiangitu at Waipareira, and that's for our kids who have left school, and we're just trying to support them on getting employment.
And, nice.
Two of the posters we put in the lift, well, hello, we found out they did selfies with them and then they took them down to take. Now, that's the best, now that's the best message for us that the campaign's working, because it's resonating with them, eh? You know, that one moment of being able to put your head up high and being proud, we don't get enough of those messages out, but they do resonate in our communities, because we saw that, hey, if young ones are doing it, then, okay, it's working. Especially on TikTok, I should say.
Yeah, TikTok's a big one these days.
Yeah, yeah. But also when you see young ones do it, then you know it's meaningful. Not cool if the old ones trying to do TikTok.
And there's a really interesting quote in your campaign video about the struggle of Māori needing to be exceptional to be seen. We need to be academics, activists, musicians, politicians. But this kind of thinking can be really damaging for our communities.
Yes, that's right, because that means that, you know, and Waipareira knows that as an organisation, that, you know, every time we deliver a service, for example, we audited three times more than any other organisation that's not Māori. It's just that having to constantly prove ourselves and what we do above and beyond, you know, rather than just being able to do things the same as anyone else. And so it was important to give that message in this video, because that is, we have to show that we do understand our communities, and that faces so many of our people. So just them knowing that we understand their struggles is just as important as saying a message about hope and belief for the future as well.
So for someone who's seen your posters, seen your video, and they're keen on the message and keen to get amongst it, what kind of support do you guys provide?
So we deliver a whole range of services. So they are health, social services, education and justice, but what we do is that we have a walk-in centre up on level 2 in our building on Pioneer Street, where we have whānau navigators who are there to look at the issues you're facing, and then they try and navigate a whole lot of services for them. Because you know what it's like? It's not just one issue, one service and one silo, is it? You've got to walk in, lay all the issues on the table and work out together with a navigator or operator how we can navigate through that and best meet your needs. It's not going to be easy, though. We know the answers aren't straight there in front of us, but we are there to help and we are there to listen. You know, after COVID, particularly this year, in March and April, this was another reason for this campaign. We've had some of the biggest numbers we've ever seen walk into our centre, because 12 months after COVID, there's massive challenges that are impacting. You know, 12 months now without a job after COVID, you know, let alone putting bread and butter on the table. And a lot of even our young kids who are at school who are having to actually take on part-time work and miss some of the schooling because their parents no longer have a job. I mean, that's a reality check that we're facing every day, and that's what we're having to deal with.
And there's a focus on urban Māori who have been detached from their language and from their community. Yeah. And that's such a unique struggle, to be detached on your own land, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's the majority of the whānau that we service in our communities, are those who have been here for at least two or three generations but no longer have a connection to the identity about who they are, no longer have a connection to any homelands that they may have come from. And it's not just as easy as, okay, let's just connect you to your homeland, or let's just connect you to your language, or let's just connect you to your land. It's not as easy as that, because you're actually having to work with a lot of our whānau who have to build up their trust and belief in themselves again. And then you have to build up their confidence. Then you have to build up their confidence so that they're no longer having to go from crisis to crisis. And then you have to build them up that they're no longer going from crisis to crisis to being resilient. You know, and then once they're resilient, how do they stand up and be the leaders in their own families? And when they're the leaders in their own families, how do they stand up and help the community? You know, it's that whole generational shift and change. It takes a lot to do that. It's not just the one-step solution to focus on now. But the message for us is Uta Māori, but it's for all Māori. And as you know, we've got Rawiri Waititi featuring in our campaign, and that's come up a number of times. But he is actually a role model for us in West Auckland. I don't know if people realise, but while Rawiri was born in Whānau Apanui on the East Coast, he was actually brought up at Waipirata in West Auckland. Grew up there in Te Atatū. Yes, went to school at Rutherford, was the leader of Kapahaka for Rutherford, did all his qualifications here. He actually became our Pō Tikanga lead for Te Whānau Waipirata, and then he became our rangatahi rep on the board. So he is the very role model that a lot of our young ones look up to here in West Auckland. And he's chosen a political career. So that's actually why he features on it. I don't think a lot of people realise that. Born and bred out of West Auckland. And so he is the very inspiration for so many of our young people in West Auckland. That's why his poster keeps getting taken out of our lift. Because it's somebody in our own community who's made it, who's unapologetically Māori, if you like. Very strong in who he is tribally, but just as strong in who he is as an urban Māori. And what more could you ask for, hey? You know, if you can have people exactly. like that in our young ones and models. And so that's why he's a huge part. People don't realise, I only see him as a MP now, but a young person grown out of our community and still very young to be an MP and a co-leader of the party is huge for us, you know. So that speaks volumes to the communities that we serve in West Auckland, yeah.
And that's a beautiful waiata that he sings throughout the video as well. I have to ask, is that going to be available to stream anytime soon?
Well, it's going on Spotify.
Good news, good news.
It's going on YouTube, and I think Rawiri wants to do something with it, but we do want to acknowledge the person who actually wrote that waiata is somebody called Dave Putter in Gisborne, and he did it many years ago as a waiata for when he was at Lytton College with his young people and teaching them to believe in themselves. And when that was written back then, Waipirata actually used it many years ago, later afterwards and changed the words a bit to use it with rangatahi, because we use that a lot with our rangatahi programs, that waiata. So it's something that's resonated for the long time, and then the Māori Party obviously picked it up, but it has a deep history. But it's just a magical, catchy tune, isn't it? You know, it's just
I
magic.
Love it. It's great.
It's cool as, eh? Yeah, we think so.
That was our Rangi Tamahere from Te Whānau o Waipirata.
Thank you so much, Lyric. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. Send us a text, give us a call if you have any thoughts on the piece that was just played, or if you've got any thoughts on the pieces that are played later. The text number is 5395 and the phone number is 309 3879. We will catch you right back shortly after a break.
The beauty of the fleeting and the ephemeral is so last century.
95BFM's popular shows, features and interviews are available as podcasts on RSS and Apple.
You're listening to Totally Wired, the all-new music show. My name is Jess Fu.
Thanks for stopping by for the 95BFM Kids Show.
Welcome back, it's True Sky.
Greetings and welcome. This is the Rhythm Selection.
So this is one for the musical theatre nerds
out there. Welcome along to Thursday Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry.
And we will let you know about Drive Island, of course.
Never miss out again. Becasts available on Apple Podcasts. Podcast or RSS for whatever podcatcher you're into.
95BFM Jazz Show presents the New Bop Quintet, performing live at the Tuning Fork. Shining a fresh light on the hard bop sound of Coltrane, Rollins and Monk, the New Bop Quintet recaptures the joy and rhythm of the era with a host of New Zealand's most esteemed jazz musicians. Mike Booth, Pete France, Kevin Field, Will Goodenson and Frank Gibson Jr., The New Bop Quintet, Tuesday, June 15th at the Tuning Fork. Get your tickets now from Moshtix.
Hi!
Hey!
Yo, what's up?
Mwah. Oh my god, thanks for coming.
You've really gone all out.
Yeah, candlelit dinner, you know?
Mmm, smells like the baths?
That's just the entree. Then we've got mutton birds with a side of swr.
Ooh, and what's for dessert?
Blue Monkey.
What's cooking? Every Wednesday evening, Johnny and Big Hungry are joined on 95BFM Drive by a very special guest for great chats about tasty tunes. What's cooking? Thanks to audioculture.co.nz, the noisy library of New Zealand music. Te pataka korihi o ngā pōru o Aotearoa.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. I'm Jemima, and Lyric is here producing with me. For our next piece today, last week in Australia, the New South Wales government condemned a Sydney primary school whose students made Black Lives Matter and anti-police violence posters for their classrooms. The students of Linfield Learning Village, a large public primary school in Sydney, made the posters as part of an exercise which required them to reflect on recent Indigenous histories. The posters used phrases like Black Lives Matter, Justice Now, and Stop Killer Cops. I spoke to Jason Wong, the president of the Linfield Learning Village Parents and Citizens Association, about the purpose of the exercise.
The exercise, well, I don't have any children that were in the stage that this was taught, but the principal has given us an update on it. So my understanding was the children were studying contemporary Aboriginal history, and they were doing a pre-learning exercise where the students were asked to identify what they already knew, basically, from different perspectives. So they were asked to look at various information sources, including mainstream media, and a couple of them found some pictures which they then replicated into those posters, and they were then asked to empathise with and then critically analyse that perspective, and asked to think about, in relation to the posters that they produced, they were asked to think about why do you think these posters were made and whether or not they were successful in achieving their aims. So that's what I understand. And I think, so from a PNC and parents' perspective, well, I think it's fantastic. I mean, this is exactly what our children should be doing. You know, they should be having a look at what's out there, what's being discussed as topical in society, and then studying it, analysing it, reflecting on it, and then drawing their own conclusions.
Following this exercise, Australia's Daily Telegraph released a story with the headline, "School Warned Over Anti-Police Pro-BLM Posters." This was on Linfield Learning Village being condemned by government officials for undertaking this exercise with their students. New South Wales government officials had said that teachers found politicising their classrooms would face disciplinary action, and a full review is currently being made into the incident. The New South Wales Minister for Education and Early Childhood Learning supplied a statement to Australia's Seven News on the issue and said that politics has no place in the classroom. David Elliott, the New South Wales Minister for Police and Emergency, told Seven News' breakfast television program Sunrise that the exercise at Linfield Learning Village was nothing short of indoctrination. He said, quote, "I do not want to see taxpayers' money going into an alleged education where children are going to walk away thinking somehow police are racist," unquote. He says that education must be apolitical. Jason Wong from the Linfield Learning Village Parents and Citizens Association says that despite the government and media backlash, the parents and school community are still very much in support of Linfield Learning Village, its principal and its teachers.
The parent community here at Linfield Learning Village is overwhelmingly in support of the principal and the teaching team. They're all pretty angry and frustrated at the original media report, and are all uniting in solidarity with each other behind the principal and her teachers, because we think the school's fantastic.
Jason then goes on to speak about the response from the government and the media.
So from what I can understand, in terms of the government, I can recall a pretty feisty response from the Minister for Police. And I did see a comment attributed to the Minister for Education. I can't really comment on the Minister for Police other than, look, he's entitled to his opinion. He's obviously seen seen what was reported in the Daily Telegraph, it probably would have been better if he maybe understood the context a little further, but I think the principal of the school has invited him to come out to the school and have a look at what the school does and how and maybe address some of his questions. In terms of the Minister for Education, yes, I did see one quote from her, but I suppose essentially or similar. Like, I don't understand the full context of those comments regarding, I think you're talking about, you know, politics should be kept out of the classroom. I suppose it depends on what you define politics as. I think if she's talking about presenting and teaching topics with a consistently biased view towards certain political perspectives, then she's absolutely right. But, you know, in my 9.5 years across 3 schools of this Department of Education, I've never seen a teacher do that. But if you see, you know, if you think of politics as teaching students about what politics actually is and how it influences our society and how it influences major decisions, then yes, our children should be learning about this and they should be critically analysing it and drawing their own conclusions. With the posters in question, I personally don't believe the posters were political. I think they were taken from mainstream media and they represent topical social issues that our children should be aware of and, you know, really should be discussing with their parents and their peers.
Since this story hit the headlines, Lynfield Learning Village principal Stephanie McConnell has apologised for the posters made by the students. I was hooked by this story. The sentiment, politics has no place in the classroom, really intrigued me. And I started thinking, where does Aotearoa stand on the inclusion of political information and discourse in the classroom and in the curriculum? I spoke to Victoria University of Wellington Senior Lecturer in Education, specialising in curriculum education policy and youth politics, Bronwyn Wood. We discussed how political issues are dealt with in New Zealand schools and what teachers need to do to ensure classroom discussions are impartial and non-biased.
Well, whether the minister recognises it or not, our classrooms are inherently political. Even the shape of the design of them or the curriculum choices that teachers make, all of those are political acts because they reflect the type of values that both schools hold, that governments hold, and that school communities hold. So we actually cannot remove politics from schools, whether we like it or not.
So how is political discussion dealt with in New Zealand schools?
Well, my experience is in social studies education, and this is where we do get into the realm of both controversial issues and political studies of sorts, because the type of issues we even select for our students to learn are inherently political. For example, we've had big debates recently in New Zealand about whether to teach New Zealand histories, but even making that decision to teach the history of Aotearoa New Zealand to our students is a political act because for many years teachers have taught Tudor and Stuart England as a choice instead. So those are actually value-laden choices that teachers are making all the time. Even the novels that you choose in English are a value-laden kind of choice. But what we do in social studies is encourage our teachers with a range of strategies to face political and contentious issues that come up in the classroom. So I've just taught a group of teacher trainees out in school now about 6 different strategies of how to deal with controversy. And we go through roles like playing the devil's advocate or playing a neutral judge on an issue, and about 6 of these roles we actually workshop so that they become more adept at the type of politics which can emerge in the topics that we encounter in the classroom.
Is there anything that New Zealand schools deem to be too political and aren't talked about in classrooms? Is there something in the curriculum that's like, oh no, we just don't go there?
Well, interestingly, we don't have anything named as such. In Singapore, they have OBTs, which are out-of-bound topics that teachers are not allowed to go near. So we're not anywhere near that. What I encourage my teachers to do is to find issues which are very politically hot, to navigate those with some care. So, for example, euthanasia or abortion, these are really politically hot and moral issues in society. And I would encourage teachers to consider carefully the classroom context and schooling context which they're in. as they're wading into those kind of discussions. But by and large, we're pretty open in New Zealand and pretty up for bringing these kind of issues in. And then what we ask our teachers to do is deal with them with care, with respect, and to encourage the type of empathy and citizenship responses that we want of all our people of New Zealand.
A core problem that has sort of popped up with this Australian case was that officials were concerned that there were biases being used by the teachers to encourage students to think a certain way, for example, be anti-police, and that potentially would lead to students being scared of police in the future. How do you deal with that idea of trying to be as impartial as possible as a teacher in a classroom, talking about hot topics, social, political issues that are very relevant today?
Yeah, well, it is a issue which requires ethical know-how and moral judgment on the behalf of teachers, which we cannot legislate for. We encourage them to reach these decisions based on broad principles of respect and human rights and social justice and equity for all. But the type of thing I would encourage teachers to do is to open up the topics in ways which encourage the contested nature of these ideas to be voiced, so that students know that there are different positions rather than, you know, telling them exactly how to think. And so we call this teaching through multiple perspectives within our curriculum area, and we encourage it a lot. We also have in New Zealand a senior social studies social action achievement standard where for credits students are asked to take personal social action. So this inherently requires them to take a stance on an issue, whether it's refugees or climate or, you know, a topical issue of their times. But what we encourage them to do is to do that in a reflective and thoughtful manner so that they can see the implications of their thoughts and actions upon other people. So we form quite a reflective and ethical kind of inquiry approach to these issues so that students can arise with good, firm understandings of that issue and therefore the implications of some of their actions. So, yeah, we place a high rate of trust on our students to do that in a way that is both empathetic and respectful of people around them.
Another thing that I have to talk about, that in this case in Australia, it was primary school students, and perhaps somebody might say that primary school students are young and perhaps don't have, I don't know, don't have the experience or don't have the ability to make that stand themselves. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that primary school students have just as much of a right and ability to go out and make their choices and decisions about these things just as much as high school students?
Yes, definitely. I've talked to 5- and 6-year-olds who are forming opinions about the world as they see it, and often and with guidance of adults around them, come up with some very thought-provoking responses to some of the biggest issues that they're facing. It's not so much an age and stage of development that enables you to think critically. It's more a disposition across all ages to think about what needs addressing and therefore what we could do ourselves to take action on this.
Just sort of finally wanted to touch on the fact that this exercise that the students were doing in the Sydney Primary School was that students were asked to reflect on recent Indigenous histories. What do you think sort of the response of the New South Wales government? Do you think that that shows anything about the politicisation of certain issues such as Indigenous or people of colour issues in comparison to majority white issues?
Well, what I would say is around the world, if we look at the moment, the Black Lives Matter has caught the imagination across multiple countries because it has so much resonance and so much need to be addressed. And so in New Zealand, we can see this with Indigenous issues on the rise, and also in Australia. And basically, the government need to realise that these are the issues of our times that the young people, whether they like it or not, are facing and need to form some positions on. So, yeah, I'm completely up for students taking on these issues and thinking them through as some of the greatest issues of our times.
I also wanted to hear from some representatives of teachers currently working in New Zealand's education system to hear their thoughts on the story involving Lynfield Primary School and whether politics has a place in New Zealand classrooms. I reached out to the New Zealand Principal Federation and NZEI, Te Reo Roa, the education union, for this. A spokesperson for the New Zealand Principal Federation provided comment. Quote, New Zealand schools do not view student participation in social issues as politicising classrooms. Many New Zealand schools supported their students in participating in public protest marches on climate change in New Zealand, which was one of the biggest protest actions we have seen in a long time. Most of our schools, which are self-managing schools, would want students to be aware of social issues such as climate change and origins and effects of racism, and indeed other social issues. Because our schools are self-managing, each school and its community, through its board of trustees, will have its own view on the appropriateness of students taking time off school to participate in public protest action. Unquote. I also spoke with NZEI, Te Reo Roa, the Education Union, President Liam Rutherford, to provide their perspective on the issue.
So teachers and principals are always looking for really rich and authentic learning opportunities. And so where you've got students coming to you wanting to play a role as an active citizen, teachers typically encourage that type of opportunity. What teachers are really constantly aware of is their own bias. And so to that extent, we know that students have had really successful learning opportunities around getting involved in wider societal issues, and we would see that as a good thing.
So this issue in Australia came out of an exercise in which students were asked to reflect on recent Indigenous history. Does the response by the New South Wales government perhaps show a greater politicisation of Indigenous and people of colour issues rather than white majority issues, perhaps?
I think the fundamental issue there is that we've got people regarding understanding your own local history as something political. It shouldn't be. I mean, students should have an entitlement to understand the Indigenous history of the land and where they're from. We wouldn't see that as anything overly political. We would see that as a right of what all students should be experiencing as a part of a well-balanced curriculum.
And I think that that question of what is political and what is not is particularly interesting, considering I know a number of students look at climate change and environmental issues day to day in their classroom, and even this last weekend it being Anzac Day and surrounding remembering the wars. That's a political issue, I suppose, in itself. So that must be an interesting dynamic to try and sort of address what is political, what is social, what does need to be talked about in the classroom.
Yeah, and I think you can definitely traverse those topics without a teacher imposing their view. They do it all the time, and it is that constant awareness of your own bias that teachers take into those conversations. But where you've got students that are particularly excited and charged up over wanting to take action within their community, I mean, those are the best opportunities that we have to have really good quality learning experiences with students.
Would introducing a civics class under the curriculum make for a more standardised way of talking about political or social issues and perhaps rub out those problems that people have with perhaps teachers making an impression on students in terms of their political views?
So we do have civics education within the social sciences curriculum, and so during a child's time in the education system, they should be experiencing that as laid out through the social sciences curriculum. What we don't have is a huge amount of consistency, and what we're seeing through a number of changes that the government has made around the introduction of, the consultation they're currently going through around the education Aotearoa histories curriculum, brings to life that role of being an active citizen as we explore our history and what that means for New Zealand moving forward. And so I think we are heading into a time where we will see greater emphasis on that.
I have also reached out to the Minister of Education, Chris Hipkins, and the Associate Minister, Jan Tinetti, to hear their position on politics in classrooms. I want to speak to them particularly about the New South Wales Government's response to Lynfield Learning Village's exercise on reflecting on Indigenous histories and whether disciplining teachers for politicising classrooms is appropriate action in a governmental sense. I hope to follow this piece up next week with an interview with one of the ministers. In this piece on the story with Linfield Learning Village and their political exercise, I spoke to Jason Wong from the Parents and Citizens Community from Linfield Learning Village. I also spoke to Victoria of University Wellington Senior Lecturer in Education, Bronwyn Wood, and NZEI Te Rerua President Liam Rutherford about where Aotearoa stands on whether politics has a place in the classroom.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
This morning, Ngāti Whātua Ōrākei kicked off their Body Warrant of Fitness, otherwise known as Body WAF program, providing free health checkups for their hapū members. I caught up with Shazaya, the Collective Impact Project Manager at Ngāti Whātua Ōrākei, to break down the basics of the Body WAF program, providing support for their community and potential future programs. So what is a body WAF?
Yeah, so a body WAF is a coined concept from like a car WAF. And what we're trying to do is simplify the health system for our 5,500 members. And what we've gone and done is identified five health checks, which are eyes, ears, teeth, some cancer checks, and also vaccinations for our farmers.
And it's kicked off this morning around 9 a.m. I've seen it go down on your Instagram story. How many people have come in already, and who have you got administering these checks?
For sure. So we've got a range of providers. We've got Dental Planet here for our dental checks, and what they're doing is a free exam and free x-rays, which is pretty much unheard of. And then what we've got is a cervical smearing van. We've got heart health here. We've also got breast screening. We've got Specsavers here doing, believe it or not, hearing and seeing, hearing and vision. And then we've got Mercy Radiology here doing all of our cancer screenings and giving out information about that. And then we've got our own Māori mobile unit doing vaccinations, which are MMR and flu jabs for all of our 65-plus whānau members. And what we've had at the moment is about 60 people come through, which is an awesome uptake. We've only been rolling, I think, for an hour and a half almost, so it's really good to see our whānau come through.
For a lot of people, making regular appointments to see your GP can be pretty daunting and pretty expensive process. But when you've got a system that's free, that's hosted by your own community, it must make a world of difference.
Yeah, to have one centralised place to access all of the fundamental health checks that you need, it makes it super simple for our whānau. The health system, we know, is hectic. It's really hard to navigate. And understanding who to go to and how to go to them can get really confusing. So what we've got is a really robust pastoral care system for our whānau, where our navigators go in, walk them through what they might need done. And if at any point they have any questions, they just come and see us and we'll pathway them to the right spaces and places.
And who kind of orchestrated this idea of a body warrant of fitness?
So this is a combined effort from Ngāti Whātua Ōrākei, our kaimahi here at Ngāti Whātua Ōrākei, and our partners at NIB Health Insurance. We're working together to ensure that all of our 5,500 hapū members get their body WAF.
Awesome, and this is your first day. How many more Body WAF days are you guys planning to host?
Yeah, sure. So this is just our soft launch. So we were expecting around 100 people in total. We're running from 9 a.m. till 3:30 p.m. We've already smashed out 60, which is phenomenal, really.
Yeah, well done, you guys.
Yeah, thank you. So because this is a soft launch, this is really just the pilot to see what can be done better. What can be done bigger. What we'll do is we'll start making this body WAF mobile, and we'll travel up and down the country to ensure all of our whānau have access to all of these checks. So to answer your question simply, not sure. We'll go however big we need to and wherever we need to ensure that our whānau get these health checks.
And are you guys the only hapū group in the country doing this? Do you know of anyone else who is also organising a similar thing?
Look, not too sure really, but everybody, every other iwi or hapu has their own way of exerting their own oranga motuhake. This is how we've decided to do ours, and so we're just running with it.
Awesome. And do you have any closing statements you'd like to make?
Of course. If you are a Ngāti Whātua Ōrākei hapu member and you live locally or you just want to pop by, come on down to 230 Cooper Street and get your body wash done. We're more than happy. The barista's coffee is going. She's only here till 10, but we've got some free kaya from 10:30 as well. So come on down, e te whānau.
Sweet as. And what time do you guys wrap up today?
We wrap up at 3:30, so don't miss the waka.
All right, thank you. That was Shazaya from Ngāti Whātua Ōrākei talking to us about their new body waff program.
Thank you so much, Lyric. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM with Jemima and Lyric. We will be right back with one last special piece making its first entrance onto The Wire after a short wee break. Here is More Big Birds by Dry Cleaning.
Brain replaced by something. With only the side of my nose for company. These and those and them ones. What you call it? It'll come to me. Brain replaced by something. With only the side of my nose for company. These and those and them ones. What you call it? Spatula pot and
Ghost Notes and Arkham City Comics presents Marlow, live at the Thirsty Dog, May 1st. Marlow is celebrating the release of his debut single, Nostalgic, with an absolutely jam-packed show, featuring special guests Mikey Havoc, Looking for Alaska, and Echo Children, and a free comic on entry thanks to Arkham City Comics, while stocks last. Marlow, Nostalgic single release, May 1st at the Thirsty Dog. Get your tickets now from undertheradar.co.nz.
Have you tried cannabis or just canna curious? Come to J-Day, a free annual community event celebrating Kiwi cannabis culture and protesting against prohibition. Learn about CBD and medical cannabis, get involved with reform efforts and enjoy the music, market stalls and more. It's never been more important to make your voice heard for fair and sensible cannabis laws in Aotearoa. J-Day, Saturday, May 1st at Albert Park, high noon till 4:20.
R18, zero waste of it, no dogs or glass. Presented by Normal with support from the Hemp Store on K Road.
Hakarongo mai, it's Māori words. Because he waka eke noa. Kei runga noa apu koe. You're awesome, you're the best.
Hey Bridge, I couldn't find that track you were looking for.
Kei runga noa atu koe, truly.
Nah, I couldn't find it.
But you looked, and that's so beautiful.
Kei runga noa atu koe, you're awesome, you're the best. Māori words, karawhiua, give it a go.
They are nicking our shit, they totally are.
The Wire.
You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM with Lyric and Jemima. For the final part of the show, we have a new segment by New Wire producers Isla Christensen and Stella Huggins. Here they are.
Hey, hey Earthlings! I'm Stella Huggins.
And I'm Isla Christensen. We've joined forces to produce a New Wire segment called The World We Know.
We want to look at some big ideas of science and society with a focus on what we as humans will be impacted by and can influence around the world on this little earth rock that we call home.
So think of it as an open letter, a discussion between two, well, three counting you good pals who just want to know where we fit into this world.
Each segment, we will be joined by experts in their field as they discuss brain chips, recycling as a measure of development, urban spaces and so much more.
We'll also attempt to do some fact-checking of TikToks so we can stop relying on a viral TikTok psychologist.
Beep, beep, boom. All right, Isla, let me ask you, if you could have music streamed directly into your brain, would you do it?
So I'd be like living in a musical?
Yes.
Sign me up.
Well, Elon Musk's new technology is promising just that and so much more. For those who haven't seen it, there's a viral video going around of a chimp playing Mind Pong. The chimp uses the Neuralink chip to move a cursor on a computer screen without actually moving its body.
And something that keeps standing out to me is they reward him with a banana milkshake for when he does it right. To tell us more about it, we're very excited to have a chat with Dr. Paul Corbulis from the School of Psychology at the University of Auckland to talk about the neuroscience of this technology and what he describes as the topography of the brain being hijacked to predict movement.
One area controls, say, the movement of the arm and hands, and the neighbouring area might control the movement of the upper arm and shoulder, and the neighbouring area to that might control the movement of the trunk, and so there's a sort of a topographical map of the body that's splayed out across the motor cortex. Implant that set of electrodes from the Neuralink, they target the area that's involved in hand and arm control. They can kind of decode the signals from there to move the cursor in the direction the monkey's thinking about moving it in.
So the technology is working in a lab context, but is it sustainable for everyday human functioning?
Elon Musk has actually tweeted that later versions of this will be able to make paraplegics walk again by shunting signals from the chip in the brain to sensors in other parts of the body.
Dr. Corbulis was hopeful about the future of this cyborg technology.
I think it's a possibility. I also think it's a technical challenge that is some way off being solved. Technically, that the concerns are more around safety and consent and ethics, and neurosurgery is not something to be taken lightly.
Absolutely, and I think it raises a further question, almost what you're saying is, just because you can, should we? And in terms of ethical, in terms of the ethical implications, is there something, because it's a fantastic technology, we should go ahead and do it, or what should we really be considering? What could this actually lead to?
Think about doing it for just kind of cognitive enhancement or you know, making it easier to tune into BFM or whatever. I'm not sure about that.
in terms of our show. We would love people to tune in, but as well, people have been talking online. Could you have you wouldn't need headphones anymore? Could there be music? And in fact, going as far as to say that perhaps you could replay your dreams. On that one, we really want to bring up and ask you, so in terms of the brain structure in charge of memories and perceptual awareness, is it possible that you could somehow replay these dreams in your head?
I think that would be a long way away.
So there you have it. It's not feasible to replay the sweet, sweet summer of 2016.
What are you trying to replay?
It was a good time, all right? So if this technology sounds kind of familiar, it's because it is. Things like cochlear implants have been in use for a long time now, so we asked Paul about Elon's ability to bring the conversation to the public domain and making the technology more common.
In Elon's public presentation, detailing the procedure, accompanied by his doctor, dressed in all medical scrubs.
Just to really make it clear that it's a doctor.
He was the doctor. So is it all for show? It's very promising technology, but Paul talks about the theatrics of repackaging already existing technology in a new, exciting way.
There's an element of, I read somewhere not so long ago, that there's an element of theatre about the whole thing, that perhaps the thing that Elon Musk and Neuralink have done more than anything else is to raise awareness in the public domain that this kind of stuff can and is happening.
We think so too. And public debate over scientific issues is very necessary to get technologies right for the average citizen.
And there really hasn't been a whole lot of debate about what are the ethical limits, what are the technological and scientific questions. Now, those debates are happening in the scientific community for sure, but it'd be good to bring it to public awareness and to think more broadly about real new frontier in human neuroscience.
So there's so much to think about. AI, tiny computers in the brain, the potential to be rickrolled in your own mind.
It's a very valid concern. And with all the potential, of course, there are concerns. Let's just revisit Elon Musk in 2018 on the Joe Rogan podcast.
The thing that's going to be tricky here is that it's going to be very tempting to use AI as a weapon.
Yikes. All right, that's enough for us this week, Earthlings.
Thanks again to Dr. Paul Corbelis for chatting with us.
That was The Wire.
That was the Tuesday Wire for another week. Thank you very much to you for tuning in and listening to the show today. Thank you very much to Lyric for being a wonderful producer.
My pleasure. Yeah. Thank you to you for being a wonderful host.
Thank you. No problem. Huge shout out to Isla and Stella for their first piece on The Wire today. Really awesome. Very excited to hear where that segment will go. And obviously a huge big shout out to the people who gave up their time to chat with us this morning for our stories. We really appreciate it. Absolutely love the fact we get to talk to experts all day long. It's awesome. But anyway, have a good day out there. I hope the weather stays all right, even though Rick says that it's going to be haily and thundery later on, which is not overly nice. But anyway, up next is a very exciting 1 to 4 with Anika. So stay tuned in for that. It'll be good.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.